Faith's Work Perfected, or Frankie's Orphan House at Haley, by A.H. Frankie, professor in the Haley University and founder of the Orphan House. Edited and translated by William L. Gage, 1868. This book has 11 chapters and 100 pages. Faith's Work Perfected, or Frankie's Orphan House at Haley. Editor's Introduction. No visitor shops at the city of Haley in Germany in order to take the great theologian Throluck by the hand, or to look at him with more timid respect in the lecture room, without halting in one of the large public squares and wondering what is the use of an immense yet not tasteless pile of buildings which cluster there and form one of the chief architectural features of the city. And in palatial importance, they entirely eclipse the University of Haley, spacious as even that is, and no hotel, no private mansion, not even that in which Napoleon took up his residency while he held the place, can be compared with it for a moment. These continuals of buildings occupies an empty square, and it is a good walk to compass it. I passed unchallenged up the staircase leading to the main entrance, thence through the lofty hall with a bookseller's shop on the one side and a drug shop on the other, into the spacious rectangle enclosed by buildings on all sides, and looked around me, endeavoring to conjecture the uses of the place. That instant an unseen bell struck. Presently the square filled with such thronging multitudes of boys and girls that it was plainly a school or a system of schools. Soon a young, intellectual-faced man walked by. Him I accosted and learned that I was standing within the world-renowned precincts of Frankie's Orphan House. A few days later, a friend took me to a little bookstall in a retired street, so retired that I wondered how anyone ever found it out. In fact, not even a bookstall, but a lodging room where a Mr. Peterson, student of divinity, kept a meager assortment of books, old and new, and now and then, through the kindness of friends, found a purchaser. This Mr. Peterson presently showed me a thick, square, worn book, very old and dingy, leather-bound, coarsely printed, and wholly unattractive. He assured me that its contents were valuable, that it contained Frankie's own account of the founding of the Orphan House, from the very inception to the perfect completion, with a valuable mass of appendices and original documents, throwing light upon the whole of the most remarkable history of the triumph of faith. For the trifling sum of 2 shillings, I became the possessor of this rare volume, whose worth I then only partly knew. The next day, as I was walking with Professor Throluck, he remarked, "Before you leave Haley, you must, if possible, possess yourself of a curiosity." I inquired what it might be. At the bookstall of Mr. Peterson's, number so and so, in such and such a street, he went on to say, "You will find a book entirely out of print, and very rarely met, the entire history from Frankie's own hand of the development of this great orphan house of Haley. The price is only 20 silver groschen, groschen. I looked at him in amazement. "How," thought I, "do you know this? You, one of the most eminent of theologians, familiar with the contents of a little retired bookstall." Of course, I was not slow to answer that only the day before I had found the book and became its possessor. That book bearing the curiously quaint title, "The Most Blessed Footsteps of the Living and Reigning, the Loving and Faithful God, for the Shaming of the Unbelieving and the Strengthening of the Believing, disclosed to the True and Circumstantial History of the Orphan House in Haley." I have carefully pursued and collated, drawing out and combining all that illustrates the great doctrines of faith and answered prayer. Much of it is now but cumulus detail, the local regulations of the school, the list of books, the catalog, resident of donations, the minute working of all the parts, but not to my purpose, and I have not used them, excepting in selections which seem to illustrate the theme. The footsteps, the first of the bundle of pamphlets, I have retained in full. It was translated into Dutch and English about 1705, but it would probably be a hopeless task to try to resuscitate a quaint English version. The work is better done afresh. Of the continuation of the footsteps, I have made a careful use and have tried to incorporate such of them as are pertinent. There are two points of significance in the work of Franke, to which special attention ought to be called. One is the great ability, learning, and scope of the man. In this respect, he seems to stand above any other, one whose career, who has been familiar to the world as exhibiting all an equally trusting faith in the living God. George Mueller, while a man of powerfully organized mind, is not known to the scholarly world as a lettered man, and never puts forth any effort to conciliate and convince the unbelief of men of nice and dainty culture. He has the simplicity of a child, but it is in his faith alone that he is most great, daring, and strong. His efficiency is that of prayer, and joining with those humble qualities which our Savior assures us are to inherit the kingdom of God. Heinrich Stilling, the well-known German mystic whose autobiography was much read years ago, was able by his downright honesty, his transparent purity, and his rare unworldliness to win even Goethe as a friend. But I have long thought that Coffee was drawn to him as a study, as representing one phase of life, as the typical pious, rather than out of any deep sympathy or thorough appreciation of the man. And there is in Stilling such a romantic love of the marvelous, such a preference of it to any other thing, and so many whimsical vagaries, not any fully unfolded in his autobiography, but hinted at, that many would not be led to confess the power of prayer after reading that quaint, simple, and richly affectionated book with its wealth of faith and domestic love, who would perhaps be hindered rather than helped. So Huntington, author of The Bank of Faith, has so much egotism, so many foolish conceits. Witness for illustration his habit of appending SS to his name on the title page of his book, and on all occasions which the reader learns at last signifies sinner saved. That one wearies of his ignorancy and of his diffuseness. True, the essence of good is there. The Christian can read that book and draw strength from it, but the man of the world, I have thought, might only be hardened by it. But Franke is an entirely different type of man. He stands out as notable in his age as Dante does in his. He was a profound scholar, an eloquent preacher, correct thinker, and a man of wonderful energy and organizing power. With Spencer, he found the order of pietism, and in an age when a subtle infidelity on the one side and the dead traditional and entirely respectable religious formality on the other were robbing Germany of all deep and quick religious life, he was one of the very few who preserved the sacred fire. Spencer and Franke and Frelinghuysen, the poet, were a trio whose Christian services in their age cannot be overrated. Anyone who reads the admirable resume of Franke's life, which is contained in Herzog's invaluable encyclopedia, will discover that great as was the founding of the orphan house, it was but a fragment of his life work. And in going over the footsteps, the reader will not discern one trait of weakness. The style is simple and direct, but utterly free from conceit and folly. Franke wins upon the reader as a wise and energetic man, wonderfully supported by his faith, wonderfully answered in his prayer, but uniting the childlike soul with a large power of influencing men, a comprehensive insight into character and great Sadducean scope of understanding. Carlyle was caricatured him in his Risible Zigzagway, History of Frederick the Great, Volume 2, page 18, and multitudes have accepted the lightning-like sketch as a faithful portrait. Did English readers, writes this remorseless pen, ever hear of Franke? Let them make a monumentary acquaintance with this famous German saint, August Hermann Francke, a Lübeck man, born 1663, professor of theology, of Hebrew, lecturer on the Bible, a wandering, persecuted, pious man, founder of the Pietism, a kind of German Methodist, who are still a famed sect in that country, and of the WAISENHAUS at Haley Grand Orphan House, built by charitable beggings of Francke, which also still subsist, a reverend gentleman, very mournful of his age now 64, and for the present at Berlin, discoursing of things eternal in what Wilhelmia thinks a very lugubrious manner, well, but surely in a very serious manner. The shadows of death are almost round this poor Francke, and in a few weeks more he had himself departed. But here Wilhelmia, what account she gives of his own and the young Grenadier Major's behavior on these mournful occasions. The king had fallen into one of the hypochondriacs and had Francke and the Haley Methodist giving ghostly counsel. His Majesty ceased to have the newspapers read at dinner and listened to Frankie's exhortations instead. Here Wilhelmia, His Majesty, began to become valetudinary, and the hypochondria which tormented him rendered his humor very melancholy. Monsignor Francke, the famous pious founder of the orphan house at Haley University, contributed not a little to exaggerate the latter evil. This reverend gentleman entertained the king by raising scruples of conscience about the most innocent matters. He condemned all pleasures, damnable all of them, he said, even hunting and music. You were to speak of nothing but the word of God only. All other conversation was forbidden. It was always he that carried on the improving talk at table, where he did the office of reader, as if it had been a refectory of monks. The king had us treated to a sermon every afternoon. His valet de chambre gave out a psalm which we all sang. In a word, this dog of a Francke led us all the life of a set of monks of La Trappe. The reader may give what credence he will to this account. I find no further proof of its accuracy than what every giddy, frivolous girl like Wilhelmina finds harsh and hard in a sedate, elderly clergyman, and what the virulent Carlyle finds in almost every Christian. Francke was an earnest, serious man, looking at life as a weighty thing, cheerful, hopeful, and happy, nowhere showing a sour, morbid spirit, and looked up to by even his opponents as a man of great talents and a pillar in the land. Another point is the magnitude of the work which he accomplished. I speak now of the orphan house, but that was enough for any man's monument. With a capital of only 14 shillings and trusting in the living God, willingness to answer the prayer of faith, and believing in the fact that he does answer the prayer of faith, he dared to begin that great undertaking and was safely carried through it, and in a very few years saw it the foremost educational institution in Germany and the most extensive ELEEMOSYNARY asylum in the world. Before his death, he witnessed over 2,000 children sheltered at once within its walls and all its departments, the orphan's home, the theological seminary, the normal school, the publishing, the bookselling, the Apocrypha's departments, the library, the establishment for widows, poor students in the university, the poor of the suburbs of Haley, and for strolling beggars in full and successful operations. It has changed but little from that time till this. The ample funds in possession of which he was able to leave the orphan house have still increased, and when I was in Haley, there were nearly 4,000 children taught there, a corps of almost 200 teachers were maintained, many living within the building, while the various appointments, the dining rooms, the reading rooms, the school rooms, hospital, the library, the offices, and gymnasium, were all that were needed for the accommodation of such a host. I will not go here into any recital of the history of the institution. This Professor Francke has fully done in the footsteps. He takes the reader through the first stage when money was counted in pence and halfpence up to the last when the house was in receipt of a princely sum every year, £4,000 coming in from a single source. Carlyle has said this was the result of charitable beggings. It was not. Frankie appealed to no man for money. The King of Prussia did, indeed, after the institution was recognized as a power, grant a license to take collection for it in the parish churches of the kingdom. But the cost and the trouble were so great that it was soon abandoned and indirectly led to pecuniary loss rather than gain. The book is an effective illustration of the truth that we live and move, as well as have our being in God, that He is a living God, the prompter of every holy work, that His Spirit does indeed work within us to will and to do after His good pleasure. Frankie relied implicitly upon such a God. He believed so profoundly in Him that his belief became act. He knew that the Spirit of God was equal to the work which he wished to see done, and he was not disappointed. He did not sit down with folded hands expecting to see a fair and stately building fitly appointed spring into being before his eyes. He worked incessantly. He planned. He brought men together. He assigned them their task. Then he prayed. He asked the living God to move the hearts of his children to give according to their means for an object whose end was the glory of Christ. Had God left him himself without a witness, this prayer had been in vain. Had there not been the Spirit of Christ in the people's heart, only needing quickening and direction, this prayer had been in vain. But the seed of the kingdom was yet in the land. Infidelity and spiritual deadness had not buried it so deep, but it might sprout yet and bear fruit to the glory of God. It is, of course, an open question whether in all the minute details of life God palpably leads us and always shows us the reason why He leads us as He does. And I think there is no advantage gained to Christianity in commencing on unanswered prayer with too close an appearance of intimacy with the divine counsels respecting our lives. The faith of some may be strengthened, but the unbelief of others may be hardened by it. But in such a work as this, as well as in that part of George Mueller's life which relates to his career as pastor in Tynemouth and Bristol, there is the evident work of the Spirit of God on the hearts of men, manifested in that normal method of diffusion beneficence which only seeks a worthy Christian object on which to bestow its gifts. The hearts of German Christians 160 years ago had the same love of Christ which animates those who live today, and it only needed to be kindled by the power of Frankie's life and preaching to prompt to giving even without direct appeal. There is surely no need of mysticism in this. It is one of the most open manifestations of the genuine Christian life, and Frankie has painted it, not in glowing colors, but in an even-tempered tone, warm and devout indeed, as he could only be, but dispassionate, calm, and overflowing with good sense and wise discrimination. An interesting fact connected with Frankie is that by the law of spiritual genealogy, he was probably the religious father of George Mueller. It is interesting to think that in Haley Mueller must have known much of the career of Frankie. He carried his recollections to England, and in due time he too, in much the same way as the German of 1700, began his orphan house. Thus do good men span the centuries. Thus being dead, they yet speak. Though they rest from their labors, their works do follow them. It seems a little thing to the readers of George Mueller's life that in his early manhood he made that sojourn in Haley during his wanderings, but it was the means, doubtless, of giving the great Bristol asylum to the world. It is a great pleasure to introduce so sound and helpful a book to the world. It has lain locked up in an obscure and difficult tongue for more than a century and a half, and yet it contains eternal, indestructible truth of Christ. To cull out this little faggot, I have had to turn over more than 1,000 pages, yet the author's kindling fever has made it a pleasant task, even when I have thought the words not concentrated enough for translation and publication. The gleanings of what is given here has been a delightful task to beguile the weary hours of a sick room away, and it has been not the least among numberless mercies that, while cut off from wanton activities by an invalid's lot, I could still speak from my chamber to the world. William L. Gage. End of the editor's introduction. Having been read by Peter John Parisi, also known as Brian Dean. None of my audios are copyrighted. Please feel free to make as many copies as you desire to the glory of God. This book now has 11 more chapters. Faith's Work Perfected, or Frankie's Orphan House at Haley. Dated 1867, this is chapter 1 of 11 chapters. Chapter 1, First Footfalls of Divine Providence. It was formerly the custom in the city of Haley and its environs for the people to appoint a certain day on which the poor were allowed to assemble at their doors and beg once a week for alms. In Glaucha, G-L-A-U-C-H-A, the little village where I live, just on the outskirts of Haley, Thursday was the day on which they came to my door to receive their weekly allowance. I used for a long time to distribute bread to them in front of the house, but I thought afterwards that it would afford an excellent opportunity for me to reach their souls with some religious instruction, for the most of them were grossly ignorant, and many were even vicious. So one day, as I stood in front of the house, I asked them all to come in. I arranged the older people on one side and the younger on another, and began in a friendly way to ask the children some questions about out of Lutheran's catechism, to see how much they knew about religion. Only the men and women listened. I did not spend more than a quarter of an hour or so in the catechism, and closed with a prayer. Then, giving them the usual gifts and telling them that in the future I should try to provide something for both body and soul, and asking them to come to my house every Thursday in the same way which they did. This was in the beginning of 1694. When I discovered the excessive ignorance of these poor people and found it hard to get an entering wedge to their minds for the first principles of Christianity, I was for a long time very much troubled to know how I could make any impression upon them. It seemed a great shame to the Christian name that so many people should grow up like cattle, without any knowledge of divine things, and especially that so many children, in the consequence of the poverty of their parents, should neither be sent to school nor enjoy good training at home, but grow up in the most scandalous ignorance and vice, and when they arrived at mature years be fit for nothing, and know nothing but how to rob and steal and commit every vice. The attempt to send children to school, giving them the money to pay their weekly tuition, did not succeed, for it was found that they asked for the money indeed, but they either did not go to school at all, or if they did go, they did not display the slightest tracks of it afterwards. I felt deeply the needs of these poor creatures who came every week to my house to get their customary alms. After a time, I bought a contribution box, and Christian students of the University of Haley and other pious people used to carry it around for me, and sometimes I collected 18 pence a week for the benefit of the poor. Still, this did not last long. The box used to come in very light, and it seemed as though it hardly paid the trouble of carrying it around. Everybody assured me of their heartiest good wishes, but the poor did not contribute because they could not, and the rich did not contribute because they would not, and it was painful to see the shifts which some were put to who pretended to be great lovers of the kingdom of God, but who refused to help me and my cause. Then I took this course. I had a box put up in the sitting room of my parsonage, with these words painted on it, 1 John 3:17, "But whoso hath this world's good, and seeth his brother have need, and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him." And under that quotation, this, 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 7, "Every man as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for the Lord loveth a cheerful giver." Thus, everyone who came into my house had to remember the poor at least, and to open or close the heart against them. It was in the beginning of 1695 that I put up this box. Then I waited a considerable time to see how God would deal with me. Before long, I found that I had the divine blessing. Sometime before I put up the poor box in the parsonage, as I was reading the Bible, I came upon these verses, 2 Corinthians 9:8, "And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye, always having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work." These words burned within me. I thought, how can God do it? I would gladly do good to many a poor soul, had I the means. But now I must let them go empty-handed away, and without any help from me. Some hours after that, I received a letter from a Christian friend who was in the depths of trouble. He was so poor that he and his whole family were threatened with starvation. He could borrow nothing more from anyone, and if for the love of God I would give him something, he would never cease to thank me. I remembered what I had just read before, and was more troubled than ever to know what to do. I wept and I prayed, and at last I determined, without holding counsel with man, to deal in a Christian way with my friend in his hour of extremity. I caused my purpose into immediate act, and during that year I gave to him £20, and rescued his family from the depths of poverty. This was an excellent proof how God could make me abound to every good work. And I could not omit giving this little incident to show the method in which God has blessed me from the beginning, and heartens me, and led me in the times of darkness. About a quarter of a year after I had put up the box in my house, a person dropped in the sum of 14 shillings. When I came to take it out and counted it over in my hand, there were 7 2-shilling pieces. I exclaimed with joy and assurance of faith, "Here is a goodly capital to work with. I must do a great work with this. I will found a school for the poor with it." I took no counsel with flesh and blood, but went on in faith and bought 6 shillings worth of books. I then engaged a poor student to instruct the children 2 hours daily. I promised to give him 9 pence a week for his trouble, with full hope that when the crown or two which I had left should be spent, God would open a way to provide me with more. The beggar children took the boy's books joyfully enough, but out of the 27 books which were distributed among them, only 4 ever made their second appearance. The children sold the others and then remained away out of shame. Still, I did not allow this to discourage me, but with the 2 shillings which were left, I bought more books, which the children always had to leave behind when school was done. After some weeks, I made a desk whence the books were always taken in the morning and where they were laid away at night, as I believe is now the custom in all poor schools. At Easter, 1695, this school of mine began with thus slender outfit. For those 14 shillings are the real base and the first capital on which not only the school for the poor was founded, but from which rose the great orphan asylum itself. End of chapter 1, having been read by Peter John Parisi, also known as Brian Dean. None of my audios are copyrighted. Please feel free to make as many copies as you desire to the glory of God. Faith's Work Perfected. Chapter 2. The Work Widens. I chose for the poor school in the summertime a room adjoining my own study, and had a box fastened to the wall with the inscription, "For educating poor children and providing them with the needful books. ANNO MDCXCV. Under the box I had this verse from Proverbs 19, verse 7. "He that hath pity upon the poor lendeth unto the Lord, and that which he hath given will he pay him again." On Whitsundaytide I was visited by some strangers who took a great deal of interest in this new institution and gave me a few crowns to help on the work. And afterwards, some other continued to deposit funds in the box, and thus to encourage my heart and strengthen my hand. Soon after this, when some of the citizens saw that the poor children were carefully instructed, they wanted to put their children also under the same influences, and so they sent them and paid 1.5 pence a week for their tuition. The teacher was employed 5 hours daily, and now received 2 shillings in addition to the stipend that I paid him. Alms were distributed to the poor children 2 or 3 times weekly to make them love better to come to school and to help make them more docile and tractable. Some people out of town heard of what I was doing and sent trifling sums of money to assist me. Others sent parcels of linen to make shirts of, to help sustain the interest of the children in their studies. The school was kept the whole summer through, and the number of pupils, including those who paid their tuition, was between 50 and 60. In all this, it was plain that the blessing of God rested upon us, for there was not a crown collected as capital which he did not himself give. I then began to receive the children of noblemen and of wealthy persons, giving them not only special instructors, but also a home with me. This was the beginning of the gymnasium. The occasion for my doing so was that some persons of influence applied to me for students to be private tutors in their families. As I could not respond to their wishes in this matter, because the students most fitted for this duty wished to continue their studies longer in Haley, I advised them to send their children to me and promised to supply them with suitable teachers. A few were brought at once. Others followed as soon as the arrangements was made public. In the summer of 1695, I received a letter from an influential Christian in which he offered me, to my entire surprise, £75, requesting me to use it entirely at my discretion for the benefit of poor students. The money arrived soon after, and I saw in it the evident blessing of God upon my work and felt greatly encouraged to continue it. This was the first large sum I had received. This put into my hands ample means for the present. I soon looked up those students who seemed to be in the greatest need and gave to them various sums, to some 6 pence, to some 12 pence and a half penny, to others 18 pence weekly, according to their several necessities. And many a poor student could live here and prosecute his studies, who never would have been able to have made ends meet without this help, and must have left the university. Some indeed had nothing at all, except what I gave them. The number whom I assisted in this way was over 20, and most of them receiving about 12 pence weekly. And this is the beginning of the flowing of that fountain which has never ceased to bless poor students at Haley from that time to this. The Lord's name be praised for it. The same summer, another Christian in high position sent me £15 for the benefits of our poor people, and a good friend sent me also £3 towards maintaining the poor school. God showed us in these ways that he would not give up what he had once begun, but would pour down his blessings upon us and do for us more than we could ask or even think. Towards autumn, I found it necessary to procure a room for my poor school, and since I had no more available space in my own house, I hired a room of my next-door neighbor. The number of children still increased so much that at the beginning of winter, I was compelled to hire even another room. I then divided the pupils and put the children of citizens, under one teacher, and the children of poor parents under another. Each teacher gave instruction 4 hours daily and received 2 shillings a week besides his room and fuel, his board and fuel. Face Work Perfected, Chapter 3, A House Needed. But I soon discovered one fatal defect in my work. Children whom one would reasonably expect to benefit received little or no advantage. Out of school, they lost what little good they gained in school. And then I made the resolution to take some children wholly under my charge and subject them to constant supervision. And that was the first call for the building of an orphan house. That the first thought which led to the great institution in Haley, conceived before I had the first pound of capital to accomplish the work. When I proposed my plan to some few friends, a spirit of interest was awakened, and £75 subscribed at once. The interest upon which £4 I was allowed to use towards helping on my end. Seeing the blessings of God upon this measure, I tried to find a poor orphan to educate with the interest of this money. Four poor fatherless and motherless children were brought at once to me, from whom to select one. Relying upon the Lord, I ventured to take all four. Yet as one was taken from my hands by a family which I trusted, I took the other three. But almost immediately, another one came in the place of the one who had been taken. I carried the four to Christian families and gave 18 pence, halfpenny, a week for the care of each child. This was in the autumn of 1695. I now learn that when one is relying entirely upon God's providence, it is just as safe giving a sovereign as a crown piece to the poor. For when trusting wholly to God, I venture to take these four poor orphans, being without the means to provide a home and clothing for scarcely one of them. For the interest of 75 pounds could hardly do this. I had committed myself unreservedly to God and relied wholly upon the promise, the Lord will provide. So the orphan house of Haley was begun without reference at all to capital on hand or to the promise of wealthy people to continue what had been begun, but solely in reliance on the providence of the living God. The day after I had taken the four orphans spoken of above, two more were brought to me. The next day another. 2 days after another, and a week after still another. So that by the 16th of November, nine were upon my hands to be brought up in different Christian families. I engaged a student of theology, George Henry Neubauer by name, to take a general supervision of them, to provide all that they needed, and to see that they lacked nothing which could contribute to their best welfare. And so these poor children were committed to me before a house was bought or hired, under whose roof they could lay down and sleep. Meanwhile, the faithful God and Father of the orphan, who can do for us altogether more than we ask or even think, provided for me more richly than with my faithless reason I should ever have dared to dream. For he inclined the heart of him who had already given me the 75 pounds to give me 150 additional at the beginning of the winter. And in the middle of the winter, another Christian of ample means sent me 40 pounds to help me in my work. Another gave me 15 pounds. Not so speak of smaller sums which came in addition. But now by the favor of God, I could not only do something to help poor students gain their education, give a home and clothes to the poor orphans committed to me, and keep in good trim the poor school, but I was able to buy the house of my neighbor, of whom I had hired two rooms before, for about 60 pounds. And in the spring of 1696, I built two apartments in the rear. The work had been begun in faith, and in faith I meant to continue it, not hesitating to provide all that was needed for the children of my charge, but at the same time guarding against procuring anything not demanded by the sternest necessity. At the time of my purchasing the adjoining house and building the two rooms on, as just spoken of, I did not think of appropriating them to the use of the orphans, now 12 in number. Yet I determined afterwards to gather them all together from the different families where they were now cared for, and have them all together under one roof. I constituted the student mentioned before the general superintendent of the infant asylum, gave him power to procure beds and bedding, to provide food and drink, to arrange for suitable instruction, and to look after the orderly conduct and cleanliness of all the orphans, in one word, to assume the duties of a father of 12 children. The removing into the newly purchased house, however, gave such dignity to the affair and caused the report of what I was doing to spread to such a degree that within 7 weeks I had 18 orphans placed under my charge. My house was filled to its utmost capacity, and the duties of the general superintendent became so onerous that I was compelled to engage another man to attend exclusively to the domestic affairs of the household. End of chapter 3. Having been read by Peter John Parisi, also known as Brian Dean, none of my audios are copyrighted. please feel free to make as many copies as you desire to the glory of God. Face Work Perfected, or Frankie's Orphan House at Haley, Chapter 4. Students Helped. Meantime, I had appointed an hour every week for the poor students, whom I helped, to meet me and receive their allowance. This gave me a good occasion to inquire into their lives and their faithfulness in study, and to form a judgment whether they made the good use of the funds which I committed to them. For with men so young, it was difficult to prevent a part of this fund being squandered on useless objects. I resolved, therefore, in God's name, to give out money no longer to the poor students, but to provide them with a free table, relying on that providence to which I trusted implicitly, to make my way clear of pecuniary straits in so doing. I thought that there would be a threefold gain in this course. The money spent in this way would go further than it could in any other way. The provisions being purchased in large quantities at a time, I could have a better opportunity of being with these young men and studying their characters than could be gained in any other way. And those who were not very needy and spent their weekly allowance in trifles were freed from that temptation. On the 13th of September, 1696, I ventured on this new experiment in trusting the Lord's goodness. 24 persons sat down to the newly established free table, including the teachers of the poor school, and in this way, one thing helped another, for I could provide board for the latter at less cost in this way than in any other way. To accomplish these new demands for space, I first hired and then purchased a house next, adjoining the one which I had bought before, and connected them by opening a door between them. They had a common garden, which made this an excellent arrangement. And all this I may call the founding of the whole institution. The reader has been informed about its feeble beginnings and its establishment. Now I have to portray its growth and a large prosperity. I was able now to give alms to the poor, not merely on the Thursdays, but every day of the week. And even poor strangers coming from out of town were hospitably entertained and received our gifts and religious instructions besides. The poor school, meanwhile, was not neglected. It continued to grow and to demand more accommodations. At the first, I had divided it into two classes, one of boys, the other of girls. When these two classes had grown unmanageably large, I divided each of them into two classes according to the age of the scholars. I put them over them suitable teachers and provided them with suitable books, and the movement was so successful that all the poor children in the city who were not able to pay for their schooling were provided by me with all the means for gaining a good education. The school for the children of the townspeople, well-to-do in the world, was also continued. In 1697, I made further enlargements in order to accommodate those who wished to pursue a wider course of studies. I appointed skillful teachers and formed classes in Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, in history, geography, geometry, music, and botany. I received fees from such parents as who were able to pay for the tuition of the children. But this I may say, because it illustrates my entire trust in Providence, that no one paid me so much as it cost to provide instruction for his child. There was a loss in every case, even where the fees were paid. The very taking of these children of parents of some means increased our own burden and compelled me to look for even greater blessings from God upon the undertaking. End of chapter 4, having been read by Peter John Parisi, also known as Brian Dean. None of my audios are copyrighted. Please feel free to make as many copies as you desire to the glory of God. Faith's Work Perfected, or Frankie's Orphan House at Haley, Chapter 5. Out from the narrow, into the broad. The number of orphans had so far increased on my hands as to make it necessary to divide them according to sex, given to each distinct teachers, and as I discovered those that excelled in talents, I selected them out and gave them instructors suited to their greater capacities, providing that they should be taught not only writing and arithmetic, but also the languages and the sciences, while those who were destined to become mechanics and artisans were instructed in the elements of Christianity as well as the three R's. The number of orphans and poor students who had board gratuitous gradually increased, and soon the houses which I had purchased became entirely inadequate to our wants. I had to begin to think about a larger house. Yet there was no model that I could follow. There was no orphan asylum then in all Germany. I could gain no clear idea of the construction and management of other establishments of a similar character in other countries, as there seemed to be no good account printed or circulated. I therefore concluded to send George Henry Neubauer, my general superintendent, to Holland to examine the orphan asylums there and to make me a report on them and the method of conducting them, so that nothing which the experience of others could teach me should be wanting to make the orphan asylum at Haley as perfect as any in existence. As my limitations became still more uncomfortably straitened, I bought the inn known as the Golden Eagle, standing just outside the Roman gate, for $1,500, and transferred my orphans thither. But I saw very soon that this house was more suitable for a tavern than for my purpose, not to speak of the constant increase of the number of orphans and poor students, who soon outgrew even these large accommodations. For in the spring of this year, there were 100 of the former and 72 of the latter, so that with the teachers and servants, there were hard upon 200 people in the house. The large open place in front of the Golden Eagle Inn was going to be appropriated for a drinking shop and other uses, which I thought not favorable to the interests of a large number of young people committed to my care. I therefore ventured to make a contract for its possession, purposing to proceed to the erection of a house which should be large enough to meet all my needs for the expense for rent to supply me with the house room I must have was not inconsiderable. And as the whole work had been conducted from the very beginning in entire dependence in the providence of God, and as I had never gone on to take any step with the means in hand for its attainment, but always in the sure expectation that God would open a way, though I had not funds in my possession sufficient to build even a small house, let alone a large one, yet God gave me courage equal to making a fixed resolution that I would go on and build at once.